Chapter 16. The Amazons Own Stonehenge. The first foreign visitor to mention the existence of megalithic circles in the Amazon was the Swiss zoologist Emilio Goldi, who travelled up the Cunani River into what is now the northern part of the Brazilian state of Amapá, near its border with French Guiana, in the late 19th century. He makes no mention, however, of formations of huge granite blocks, obviously worked upon and moved into place by human beings, overlooking a stream called the Rego Grande. In the 1920s, Kurt Nimwendaju, a German-Brazilian ethnologist, also visited megaliths in the region, but he likewise appears to have been unaware of the spectacular formations of Rego Grande. They were seen, however, and noted by Betty Meggers and her colleague Clifford Evans of the Smithsonian Institution in the 1950s. And now at last, with the Smithsonian's resources, came the opportunity for a thorough investigation of the mysterious site. Predictably, what we might call the curse of Meggers descended upon the Rego Grande stone circles. These great formations of megaliths shouldn't have existed at all, according to her prejudices about the ancient Amazon, and were thus deemed unworthy of further excavation. Thereafter, lacking the Smithsonian seal of approval, the interesting problem of Rego Grande was quietly set aside and ignored by archaeology for the next 40 years, while the site itself fell back into its former state of absolute obscurity and was in due course forgotten. But climates of opinion in scholarship from time to time undergo radical shifts, and forgotten things sometimes cry out to be remembered. Thus, just as the geoglyphs of Acre were first identified back in the 1970s in an area where swathes of formerly dense rainforest were being cleared for use by the cattle industry, so it was with the Rego Grande stone circles. They were rediscovered in the 1990s by ranch foreman Leilson Camelo da Silva, who was clearing land for pasture. "I had no idea that I was discovering the Amazon's own Stonehenge," he later told a reporter. "It makes me wonder what other secrets about our past are still hidden in Brazil's jungles?" The publicity around Silva's discovery, coupled with new insights into the complexity of ancient Amazonian civilization, led to a gradual reawakening of interest in Rego Grande. More research was done, and out of roughly 200 prehistoric sites identified across the state of Amapá, it was found that 30 had megalithic monuments of one kind or another. In 2005, archaeologists Mariana Petri Cabral and João Darcy de Moura Saldana of Amapá's Institute of Scientific and Technological Research set about the task of surveying them all, with a particular focus on Rego Grande. There, the principal stone circle, which has a diameter of 30 meters, consists of 127 upright megaliths. Brought from a quarry 3 kilometers away, the megaliths weigh up to 4 tons each and stand between 2.5 meters, just over 8 feet, and 4 meters, just over 13 feet tall. Areas within the circle were used for elaborate human burials involving funerary urns and vases in a known pottery style of the region. By 2011, a preliminary age of about 1,000 years was being suggested for the site. This was based, according to Mariana Cabral, on 3 date checks on fragments of charcoal found among pottery in the burial area. 10 other prehistoric sites in the state of Amapá, 3 of them with megaliths, were also dated in the same way, and all seem to have been occupied between 700 and 1,000 years ago. Much more work will have to be done before we can be sure that these dates will not be revised, like the ages of the geoglyphs, in the light of new evidence. Most important, meticulous care will have to be taken to be certain that the stone circle on the one hand and the burials from which the carbon-14 dates were derived on the other are works of the same period. The phenomenon of intrusive burials is one that archaeologists commonly encounter. Particularly where an ancient sacred site is involved, there is a tendency for later peoples to want to bury and sanctify their dead there. Such anachronistic burials have been found, for example, at the Sphinx and at the Third Pyramid of Giza. The danger, therefore, is that an older site will be given a falsely young date based on materials from the intrusive burial. Indeed, Cabral and Saldana note that pottery of the same style and type as the pieces at Rego Grande, from which the samples of charcoal were taken, is common along all the northern coast of Amapá and in French Guiana, and has also been regularly found in prehistoric sites that have no stone monuments. I'm therefore not convinced by the association of this pottery and carbon-datable charcoal with the original construction date of the stone circle at Rego Grande. That being said, however, it makes no difference to me if it does turn out to be of the same age as the burials. My argument is not that every mysterious monument now emerging from the depths of the Amazon must date back to the Pleistocene. I'm concerned here rather with the manifestation of a legacy of ideas that may be of Ice Age antiquity, ideas involving geometry, and ideas also very much involving astronomy. It's the ideas that matter, whether we encounter them in the Amazon, or at Serpent Mound in Ohio, or at Angkor in Cambodia, or at Stonehenge in the British Isles, or among the monuments of Egypt's Giza Plateau. If mechanisms to carry, preserve, and transmit them down the generations have been introgressed into the local cultural DNA, then I see no reason why they should not manifest and reveal their fundamental similarities wherever and whenever conducive circumstances arise. It therefore has to be of interest, whatever the age of the great stone circle at Rego Grande ultimately proves to be, that it appears to share a key meme with Stonehenge and with Serpent Mound. Coined by Richard Dawkins in his 1976 book The Selfish Gene, the word meme refers to an element of a culture or system of behavior passed from one individual to another by imitation or other non-genetic means. In the case of Stonehenge, Serpent Mound, and Rego Grande, the meme concerns the orientation of the sites, which in all three cases honors the sun on the June and December solstices. We reviewed these alignments for Stonehenge and Serpent Mound in Part 1, and the listener will recall that they are reversible. That is, an alignment to the summer solstice sunrise is also, in the reverse direction, an alignment to the winter solstice sunset, while an alignment to the winter solstice sunrise is also, in the reverse direction, an alignment to the summer solstice sunset. In the case of Rego Grande, it is the winter solstice that is the primary focus. Cabral and Saldana point to a megalith that uses shadow effects to track the sun's path throughout this day. Two other granite megaliths close by, one with an artificial hole cut through it, also line up to track the rising point of the winter solstice sun. The strong foundations of the site make it unlikely that the megaliths would have shifted position. Even blocks lying horizontally, it turns out, have not fallen, but were purposefully placed. Those lying on the ground never stood upright. Instead, the layer of laterite beneath them was carefully dug so that they fit snugly with the ground. Excavations carried out around the bottom of the standing stones also revealed small blocks of granite and laterite, which were used to wedge the monoliths at this unusual angle. Cabral and Saldana's conclusion is that all the angles were carefully considered by those who conceived them. Archaeologist Manuel Calado of the University of Lisbon, an expert on Portuguese megaliths, agrees. "I'm sure," he said, after a visit to Rego Grande, "this is one of the aspects that makes the Amazon megaliths very similar to those in Europe." Richard Callahan, professor of archaeology at the University of Calgary, is also on Cabral and Saldana's side. "Given that astronomical objects, stars, constellations, etc. have a major importance in much of Amazonian mythology and cosmology, it does not in any way surprise me that such an observatory exists." For Eduardo Neves, too, "the idea of the place being a sort of observatory is a good one, although he adds, quite rightly, that we still need to test it." Painel do Pilão. Only the most rudimentary survey has been undertaken at Rego Grande, enough to reveal the major solstitial focus of the Great Stone Circle, but nothing more. Other much richer information may or may not be concealed within the multiple alignments of the megaliths, as is the case at Stonehenge and Serpent Mound, but a major archaeoastronomical study will be required to settle the matter. As Jerita Holbrook, Associate Professor of Physics at South Africa's University of the Western Cape, comments, "it takes more than a circle of standing stones to get a Stonehenge." I would add, however, that a circle of standing stones with a solstitial alignment is a pretty good start. Moreover, and I suggest of great relevance given the uncertainty over the dates of Rego Grande, a major archaeoastronomical study has been undertaken at another Amazonian site, approximately 550 kilometers to the southwest. Named Pinal do Pilau, it is located just 400 meters from Pedra Pintada, the painted rock shelter investigated in 1996 by Anna Roosevelt. We heard in Chapter 12 how she and her team excavated multiple occupation layers within the shelter, the oldest and deepest of which turned out to be perhaps as old as 16,000 years, according to thermoluminescence dating, and 14,200 years, according to radiocarbon dating. There has been no serious challenge to these dates, but following further work by Roosevelt, Pedra Pintada's rock art is now usually reported, reflecting the current cautious consensus of the archaeological community, to date between 13,630 and 11,705 years ago. Dates for the art at the nearby Pinal do Pilau rock shelter excavated by Christopher Sean Davis of Northern Illinois University are closely similar, being variously given in his 2016 report at between 13,014 and 12,725 years ago, and between 13,135 and 12,810 years ago. Altogether, a total of four samples from two adjacent excavation levels were subjected to carbon-14 testing. All were found, says Davis, to be consistent and contemporary to Roosevelt's Paleo-Indian dates from Caverna de Pedra Pintada. His conclusion, therefore, is that the initial artworks of Pinal do Pilau were created at around the time the area was first inhabited, 13,000 years ago, and that those earliest images, which were probably retouched or traced more recently, were positioned in the most prominent wall locations and height. Davis suggests that the rock wall itself, as well as the floor at its base, were deliberately leveled by the ancients to form a 90-degree angle to one another. The whole ensemble, he says, was made straight and flat throughout to configure a platform stage from which an observer can view the rock art from a specific location. Once standing in that location, Davis further notes, the painting most central to the observer's field of view is a grid image that has individual boxes marked with mostly repetitive but some varying tallies. It looks like a calendar, and indeed some years before Davis, Roosevelt was the first scholar to consider that possibility. While recognizing that alternative theories not related to astronomy cannot be ruled out, Davis reinvestigated the matter over the course of a solar year and noticed a possible pattern to do with the intersection of the setting sun to a rocky perch in the near distance above and to the right of the painted outcrop. The annual movement of the sun relative to the rocky perch allows for the intersection of the setting sun through the center of the perch approximately 18 to 20 days before and after the winter solstice, which currently occurs on December 21. If each box of the painted grid image represents one day of observing the setting sun relative to the rocky perch, 49 days after the day of the winter solstice, the sun sets too far to the north of the rocky perch, entirely missing the structure. The grid painting has 49 total boxes, and the center boxes have tally marks that are simply vertical lines. Most other tally marks are crisscrosses. The rocky perch and the grid image might therefore have been a way for Paleo-Indians to foretell the winter solstice and the passage of a new year. What adds to the likelihood that Davis is correct is that he and his team found other alignments at Pinal do Pilau. For example, just as the orientation of what they call the platform stage suggests an ancient focus on the December solstice sunset, so too, another prominent cluster of images aligns to the rising point of the sun on the June solstice. Meanwhile, a third astronomy alignment occurs with a single red pictograph discovered above the excavation unit on a vertical ledge on the underside of the painted outcrop. The ledge may have been intentionally altered, but further investigation is needed for certainty. The painted circle itself faces 270 degrees, the azimuth of sunset on the equinox, but the shelter walls block all views of the western horizon or sky from this location. However, just beneath the circle and ledge is an opening that allows one to see through to the other side of the outcrop and the horizon beyond. This vantage point, beneath the painted circle, aligns to 90 degrees, the position of the rising sun on the equinox, which occurs on March 20 and September 23 currently. At the very least, says Davis, the rock art and alignments at Pinhal do Pilão tell us that cultures in the heart of the Amazon 13,000 years ago engaged and utilized sophisticated knowledge of astronomy maintained through rock art and possibly shared or reimagined by more recent cultures who either inherited or rediscovered the ancient paintings. He's right to draw attention to the legacy aspect of all this, the possibility, long after the original painters and horizon astronomers of Pinhal do Pilão were gone, that later cultures might have inherited and reimagined the ancient ideas and obsessions manifested there. This is how we would expect carefully crafted and cleverly designed memes to propagate themselves down the ages. And it appears to echo exactly the process at Serpent Mound, which was likewise maintained, renovated, and reimagined by successive cultures down the ages, and which likewise signals the solstices and the equinoxes. Pinhal do Pilão is important because it tells us that the meme of sacred structures aligned to the solstices and equinoxes found in monumental art and architecture all around the world has been present in the Amazon for at least 13,000 years, and perhaps we must await future discoveries in the unexplored reaches of the jungle for far longer than that. It also has wider implications. If people were capable of carefully marking, recording, and honoring these celestial events in South America 13,000 years ago, then there's no good reason to suppose that they should not have done so in North America as well, and therefore no good reason to dismiss the possibility that Serpent Mound's original alignments also go back to that distant epoch. Archaeology says a firm no to this, accompanied by guffaws of derision. As we've seen, however, the archaeology of Serpent Mound is riddled with contradictions and uncertainties and appears to have produced dates marking various episodes of restoration and renovation rather than convincing evidence of when the monument was originally designed and founded. Hypothesis. In his report, Christopher Davis mentions Rego Grande, presumed to be more recent than Pinhal do Pilão, as another Amazonian site at which archaeoastronomical alignments have been investigated. He draws no specific connection beyond that, but in my view, the confirmation of a solstitial focus at both, as also at Serpent Mound in Ohio and Stonehenge and other megalithic sites worldwide, is noteworthy. Moreover, although there is no henge at Rego Grande, we've seen that the solstitially aligned stone circle there shares the Amazon basin with huge numbers of henge-like earthworks. We've noted how these two have never been subject to any kind of rigorous archaeoastronomical investigation. Meanwhile, the total number of geometric ditched enclosures discovered in the southwestern Amazon survey area had increased from over 210, the figure on record in 2009, to over 450 by 2017. Then in 2018, a further study by Denise Shan and colleagues reported an extension of the survey area across much of the southern rim of the Amazon basin. The results show that an 1,800-kilometer stretch of southern Amazonia was occupied by earth-building cultures. In one area alone, the upper Tapajos Basin, 81 previously unknown pre-Columbian sites were discovered, with a total of 104 earthworks. Among them were many complex enclosures, including one 390 meters in diameter, featuring 11 mounds circularly arranged at the center of the enclosure. The researchers suggest that at least 1,300 further sites remain hidden within the jungles of the Amazon southern rim, a number they add that is likely to be an underestimation, while huge swathes of the rainforest are still unexplored. They remind us that the terra firme forests that account for around 95% of the Amazon are particularly uncharted because these areas have been archaeologically neglected following traditional views that pre-Columbian people concentrated on resource-rich floodplains. However, the discovery of large pre-Columbian earthworks in terra firme along the southern rim of the Amazon undermines the assumption that these areas were marginal in terms of past human impact and the development of complex societies. It is undoubtedly the case that many more structures remain to be found than have already presented themselves to science. Our entire understanding of this vast region is being transformed by new discoveries. And indeed, as we've heard, the notion of complex societies in the pre-Columbian Amazon is no longer anathema to archaeologists, some of whom now even dare to describe those societies as civilizations. Given that such civilizations existed in ancient Amazonia and clearly had the capacity to manifest their ideas in great public projects, it's intriguing that the end result was the vigorous, flamboyant, and extensive expression of the very same architectural, astronomical, and geometrical memes that characterize sacred architecture in many other parts of the world and at many different periods. An analogy between genetics and culture, genes and memes, can serve us well here. Let's say, purely hypothetically, of course, that a system of ideas is transferred by direct teachings from one culture to another. The recipient society as a whole, however, may not yet be ready to put the teachings into practice. What is required then is that some sort of institution be set up that can recruit the brightest and the best from the local population. They, in turn, will draft new talent with each new generation, initiating them and training them in the essential details of the system, which will assume the character of a religion and will in due course integrate itself deeply into every level, even into the habits of thought of the recipient culture. Eventually, when the right time for the next stage of the project is judged to have arrived, perhaps very soon, perhaps after thousands of years, depending on local circumstances, the religious leaders will mobilize the population to enact the great projects of sacred geometry that had for so long remained encoded but unexpressed within their cultural DNA. It is, I emphasize, only a hypothesis. In this context, though, it's thought-provoking to consider an ethnographic report from 1887 written by a certain Colonel Antonio R.P. Labre, after he had ascended the Madeira, the Beni, and the Madre de Dios rivers, and then crossed overland to the Acre River. His journey took him right through the heart of the geoglyph territory of Acre, and involved numerous encounters with its inhabitants, the Araona people, who had by that time been reduced to a tiny remnant after hundreds of years of devastating epidemics, slave raids, and murderous attacks by commercial rubber tappers seeking to drive them off their land. It was not uncommon, writes Denise Shan, for rubber tappers to capture native women for wives. The encroaching whites would frequently promote raids to enslave the native population for the rubber industry, a situation that 40 years later would result in the near extinction of tens of thousands of natives. Since all work on the geoglyphs had ceased hundreds of years previously, we can only guess how much of the past of their once great culture these harried, encroached upon, and deeply endangered Arawanas remembered by the time of Labre's visit. We cannot even be sure that they were the direct descendants of the geoglyph builders, rather than of more recent migrants to the area. Nonetheless, what Labre tells us feels significant. He didn't see the geoglyphs, which were then entirely overgrown by jungle, but he was in the midst of them on August 17, 1887, when he stayed overnight at an Arawana village called Mamuseda. He describes there being, as well as plantations, about 200 inhabitants, a form of government, temples, and a form of worship, from which, together with knowing the names of the idols, women were excluded. Of particular importance and relevance here is Labre's report. The idols are not of human form, but are geometrical figures, made of wood and polished. The father of the gods is called Empimara. His image has an elliptical form and is about 16 inches high. Although they have medicine men charged with religious duties and remaining celibates, the chief is nevertheless pontifex of the church. Consider the improbability of this if it does not arise from some real, though forgotten, connection. Here in a landscape mysteriously inscribed in antiquity with vast geometrical earthworks, at a time when the earthworks themselves had long since been swallowed by jungle, we find a Native American tribe whose gods take the form of polished wooden geometrical figures. The tribal chief is the religious leader, but there are also medicine men who likewise have religious duties. It already sounds exactly like the sort of institution for the replication and transmission of geometric memes that I proposed as a hypothesis earlier. But it gets even more interesting when the shamans involved, and often the population, are drinking ayahuasca.